I'm sure many of you are aware that our speaker had hoped that there would be a spokesman for the evolutionist viewpoint on the platform here tonight. Certainly, in view of the prevailing modes of thought widely expounded in our science classrooms, and textbooks, and journals, one would think that there would be any number of capable individuals to present evidence and arguments in support of evolution at a forum such as this. But I am told that no one in the various science divisions who was contacted was willing to do so, was willing to come and debate our speaker. I suppose one can only wonder what the reason might be. Surely one would think that if the evolutionists have strong grounds for their views, that they would be quite happy to present them publicly at a forum such as this. But we'll have to rely on the questions from the floor, I suppose, from the opposing viewpoint. Our speaker is the director at the Institute for Creation Research and vice president for academic affairs at the Christian Heritage College, San Diego, California. By way of education, he has a Bachelor of Science degree with distinction from Rice University, his graduate work, a master and doctoral degree from the University of Minnesota with a major in hydraulic engineering. He's had various academic posts in the country, professor and head at the Department of Civil Engineering at Southwestern Louisiana, 51-56, professor of applied science, Southern Illinois University, 57, professor of hydraulic engineering and chairman of the Department of Civil Engineering, Virginia Polytechnic Institute, 1957 to 1970. And since that time, he's been actively associated with the present affiliation. He's had numerous honors, listed in many biographical listings, and many activities with the field of research in hydraulic engineering. Among the many books that Dr. Morris has written, such as Science, Scripture, Salvation, Studies in Bible and Science, The Bible and Modern Science, Science and Creation, Applied Hydraulics and Engineering, a textbook widely used, The Remarkable Birth of the Planet Earth, Many Infallible Proofs, Scientific Creationism. Altogether, he's authored over 100 articles on this subject, the author of many articles in hydraulics, and journals, and research monographs, and so forth. So without further ado, our speaker tonight speak on case for creationism, Dr. Henry M. Morris.
Well, thank you very much. It's certainly a very distinct honor and privilege, as well as a pleasure, to be here at the University of Kansas. First visit. I'm enjoying it and look forward to maybe sometime in the future coming back. I might say just a word about this question of debates. We're not so much interested in winning debates or even participating in debates as we are simply of winning a hearing for creation. As perhaps you know, the evolutionary concept, the evolutionary model, as I would call it, the theory of evolution, as others would call it, or the fact of evolution, as many would call it, has been taught exclusively in colleges and universities and public schools for a long time. But many of us are convinced that the concept of special creation is a better model within which to explain the origin and development of the universe and of life and of man. At least it can be presented in a credible scientific fashion so that it, in an open society and a free academic environment and so on, why, it ought to be available and taught as well as evolution. But for some reason it has not been. So we're interested in getting the information available to college students and others, and we're grateful for this opportunity of presenting to you the case for creation tonight. Appreciate your coming and your apparent interest in this subject. I might say just a word about the Institute for Creation Research so that you'll understand this is kind of a unique organization, and maybe don't know exactly what it is, but it's associated with our college there, and both of them are new organizations. Our college is a liberal arts college, but it's a curricula, it's degree programs, and we have about 18 of them now, are all structured around this concept of creation rather than evolution, as is true in most other schools. And then the Institute is a research organization. We have three activities: research and writing and teaching, in promoting the concept of scientific creationism. And I emphasize the term science because most people have the notion that the concept of creation is simply religious. And as a matter of fact, often when we go to a school or college or somewhere and suggest that creation be taught along with evolution as an alternative theory, we get the response, well, but you can't do that because creation is religion. Evolution is science. You can't teach religion in a public school, so you can't do that. Well, I realize that that's the prejudice that many people have against the concept of creation, but we want to try to show tonight that you can make a credible scientific case for it, as well as raise some very legitimate scientific questions and difficulties against the concept of evolution. So we're not going to be discussing the book of Genesis tonight or other religious concepts or literature. We're going to be presenting scientific creationism. But just to sort of set the stage, let me read first from a leading evolutionist. Matter of fact, I'm going to be documenting much of what I say tonight because I'm no authority in all the different fields that relate to evolution, certainly. I'm not a biologist. I did do my graduate minor work in geology. But as a matter of fact, evolution embraces all fields, and so does creation. The two concepts really are worldviews. So no one person can be an authority in every field that deals with this. So therefore, when I make a point, I'm going to try to document that with statement from someone who is an authority in that particular area. And also, I would note that all of the men whom I will quote are evolutionists. So I want you to understand that I'm not quoting out of context, but I recognize that these men would not agree with what I'm saying. I'm just using their statements to document the particular facts to which I want to call your attention. Dr. René DeBose, one of our leading evolutionary ecologists today, in an article entitled Humanistic Biology, the American scientist several years ago, said, "Most enlightened persons now accept as a fact that everything in the cosmos, from heavenly bodies to human beings, has developed and continues to develop through evolutionary processes. Evolutionary concepts are applied also to social institutions and to the arts. Indeed, most political parties, as well as schools of theology, sociology, history, or arts, teach these concepts and make them the basis of their doctrines. Thus, theoretical biology pervades all of Western culture indirectly through this concept of progressive historical change." So you understand we're discussing more than just a biological theory. Sometimes I hear people say, well, don't get it. Who cares about that? Let the biologists worry about it. It's simply a biological theory, but it's much more than that. It pervades every field of study. It's basically a philosophy of life. It's a worldview, a cosmology. So even engineers are concerned with that. And all of us have a stake in this issue of origins, where we came from and why we're here and where we're going. That's basically what it is. Well, I do know that most people in the science areas and educational world consider evolution to be a fact. But let me quote from the latest edition of Darwin's Origin of Species. This is the 1971 edition of Charles Darwin, Origin of Species. Now, maybe you didn't know that Darwin revises his book every once in a while. Of course he doesn't, but I suspect that maybe he would like to if he could. At any rate, a new edition does come out every once in a while with a new foreword written by a current leader in the field of evolutionary thought to put it in current perspective. And this latest edition, published in London in 1971, the foreword was written by L. Harrison Matthews, fellow of the Royal Society and a prominent evolutionist in Britain. He was chosen to write this, and note what he says. Dr. DeBose says, "All enlightened persons accept evolution as a fact." Now, Dr. Matthews says in his foreword, "In accepting evolution as a fact, how many biologists have paused to reflect that science is built upon theories that have been proved by experiment to be correct? Or remember that the theory of evolution has never been thus proved. The fact of evolution is the backbone of biology, and biology is thus in a peculiar position of being a science founded on an unproved theory. Is it then a science or a faith?" I know what he says. "Belief in the theory of evolution is thus exactly parallel to belief in special creation. Both are concepts which believers know to be true, but neither, up to the present, has been capable of proof." Now, we creationists acknowledge that we cannot scientifically prove creation. This is a matter of history. If creation is true, it's possible, it is true. I think everyone would agree that it's at least possible that there might be a God, and that if there is a God, he might create. I think everyone would allow for that possibility. So it's a possible fact of history, and if it is true, then it took place in the past and isn't taking place now, and therefore we can't study it now. That is, we can't bring it into the laboratory and make measurements on it to see how it works. And that's what science is, you see. Science is knowledge. The essence of the scientific method is experimental observation and repetition. And we can't bring creation to the laboratory to repeat it, to see how it works. And we recognize that. But you see, exactly the same is true of evolution. As Dr. Matthews says, belief in the theory of evolution is exactly parallel to belief in special creation. They're concepts which believers believe, but you can't prove them. Because if evolution is true, although supposedly you can see it, it's still taking place. As a matter of fact, it's so slow that you can't see it. To produce a variation such that you'll develop a higher kind from a lower kind, and that's what we're talking about. No creationist argues about horizontal variation. All of us accept, for example, the idea that the peppered moth shifted from dominant light coloration to dominant dark coloration, or that fruit flies develop mutations, or all the varieties of dogs have come from the same ancestral dog. We all accept that. We're not arguing that point. We're not talking about horizontal change, you see, but vertical change. And in the sense of a increase in complexity from one kind to a higher kind, ultimately from, say, amoeba to man, or particle to people, because evolution embraces the whole of the universe, supposedly, you don't have time to observe that. It takes millions of years for that sort of change, and nobody can observe that either, so that's outside the scope of the experimental method. Neither one is scientific, then, in the sense that we can ultimately prove or disprove. They're on the same level. Each is a matter of faith. Now, why then say that creation is religion, but evolution is science? They're both on the same level. Both require faith. Both have religious implications, but both can be discussed scientifically. And that's what I want to do. I want to try to show that the creation model fits all the facts of the scientific data which we can observe just as well as the evolution model does. Both can be made to fit all the facts because we can't bring them into the laboratory to test them. So by stretching the model and making it flexible enough and adding secondary assumptions, you can make a model which will fit anything if you want to badly enough. You can do that with either concept. But basically, what we want to do is to try to approach the two concepts of origins, creation and evolution, in the simplest terms possible, and then see which one, in the simplest form, fits the facts more directly, with the smallest number of these modifications to make it fit the facts. Now, in the simplest terms, evolution would say that the evolutionary model would say that we can explain everything, the origin and development of all things, from primeval random particles up to complex particular people today, in terms of natural laws and processes that are operating in the universe, in a self-contained universe, still going on. We don't invoke an external supernatural agent of some kind to explain it. Everything is explainable in terms of the natural laws and processes which we can measure and observe today. That's the evolutionary model. Creation model says you'll never explain the world that way. Creation model says in order to explain the world as it really is, you have to have a period of special creation in which the basic systems of nature, the basic laws of nature, the basic categories, the basic structures of the universe, and the basic kinds of plants and animals, and especially man, were all created, fully created, complete right from the start. And that the processes which have continued in the world since the time of creation have been for the purpose of accomplishing the purpose of the Creator in creation. In other words, they are the operational processes by which He is conserving and maintaining and operating the universe. That's the creation model. Now, these are two different concepts, and so they lend themselves to comparative evaluation in terms of their ability to correlate and predict data. And, of course, it's a big field of study. There's a course here. I've had the privilege of being in the class this morning, a course in evolution. They go all semester on the subject of evolution. At our college, we have a course in scientific creationism, which goes all year, has 90 hours of class work and a lot of homework and outside reading and so on. And so obviously we can't cover the whole scope tonight. But picking out a couple of points, what I want to emphasize in particular is the question of the time factor. Has there been enough time for evolution? What are the real factual data with respect to the age of things and the origin of things, the time factor, And I will try to show that there's no good evidence that the Earth is old enough for evolution to be conceivable or feasible. And the second thing is, even if there is enough time, is it possible? And I would try to show that in terms of what we know about the laws of science, no matter how many billions of years you might have available, evolution is still not possible in terms of the basic processes of nature, in terms of what we know about them and the order of nature today. Now, I can't prove this in the ultimate sense, understand, because you cannot repeat history. You can't bring the origin of the universe into the laboratory to see how it works, or the origin of man or anything. But in terms of the ability to fit the facts that we do have, I want to try to show that there's no good evidence that the Earth is all that old, and even if it is, there's no good evidence that evolution is possible. And that being the case, then there's only two alternatives, either creation or evolution, in terms of whether the universe can be explained by continuing natural processes or by completed supernatural processes. These are the two possibilities. Well, in terms of the time factor, I think most evolutionists would agree that you have to have a great deal of time available for evolution. Obviously, nobody has seen any real evolution in the vertical sense from one degree of order to a higher degree take place within recorded history. And therefore, it obviously takes a lot of time if it really happens. Nobody sees one kind evolving into a higher kind. We see horizontal changes. Peppered moth, distant vitularia. After the Industrial Revolution, it changed from dominantly light to dominantly dark. But this is simply allowing the variational potential that's already in the genetic system of that moth to express itself when the environment changes. It adapts to the environment, has that potential. And now that the environment's clearing up over there, a recent article about a year ago indicates that the coloration is shifting back again towards the light color. So that these are just horizontal shiftings. These are not evolution in the sense of a vertical change from one degree to a higher degree. But there must be that kind of change, you see, if evolution is true. Now that's to have that kind of change in, you obviously have to have a lot of time. Nobody ever sees evolution. And remember, science is what you can see. So evolution is not science. You can't see it. Well, I've read sometimes about changes like that, that is, big changes taking place. I read about frogs turning into princes, and mice into footmen, and so on. But you don't read that in the book of science. If you have something like that, you see, you immediately say, well, here's magic. You have to have some kind of a magic wand to do that. Well, but I'm not just being facetious. Now, what is there that changes the situation? If you have a frog turning into a prince rapidly, you would call it magic. But if you let an amphibian turn into a human being over 100 million years, call it science. What is there about the 100 million years that turns magic into science? Well, at any rate, you have to have lots of time. Nobody sees that sort of thing taking place. Well, we ask the evolutionists about that. The evolutionists have proved fact of science, yet we don't see it. How come? Well, they say the reason you don't is because it goes so slow. It takes millions of years to produce the kind of change you're talking about. But these small changes, which you do see, the mutations which you measure on the fruit fly or the bacterium and so on, if you let these go on long enough, and if they happen to be good, then natural selection will take over and preserve them, and gradually you'll develop higher kinds. Well, maybe so. If you have long enough time, maybe that's what happens. So we ask where to go to see that kind of evidence. If evolution is a fact of science, we ought to be able to see it somewhere. So now the suggestion is the fossil record. And here, supposedly, we do have the documented record of millions of years of Earth history, hundreds of millions or billions of years. And as you go into the very old rocks, you find simple forms of life in the fossils. As you go to more recent rocks, you find complex forms of life. So here, supposedly, we do have the picture preserved for us, documented, of evolution from simple to complex over the ages. Dr. Dunbar, the widely used historical geology textbook, says, although the comparative study of living plants and animals can give convincing circumstantial evidence, fossils provide the only historical documentary evidence that life has evolved from simple to complex forms. So the fossil record is very important. But as you go to the fossil record, you are amazed, I think you would be, maybe, if you don't really know about the evidence, to learn that the fossil record is full of the same kinds of gaps that the present world is. In other words, in the present world, we have an array of plants and animals which have been classified into species, genera, and so on. And what we have is distinct kinds cats, for example, with a lot of varieties of cats, and dogs, for example, with a lot of varieties of dogs, but a gap between the cat and the dog. In other words, we have variations inside the kind, but gaps between the kinds. And that's exactly what you would expect to find if creation is the true model, because that's what the creationist would say, that's what he would predict would be the case. Creator would make basic kinds with the ability to vary inside the kind so they could adjust to the environment and not become extinct when the environment changes, with similarities between the kinds if they have similar structures, but differences between the kinds if they have different purposes, an array of similarities and differences, variations inside the kind and gaps between the kinds. That's what the creationist expects, and that's what we find in the present world, and that's exactly what you find in the fossil world. Let me quote, for example, from David Kitts at the University of Oklahoma, professor of geology there. In the article Paleontology and Evolutionary Theory, he says, despite the bright promise that paleontology provides a means of seeing evolution, that's where we go to see the evidence, in other words, nevertheless, he says, it has presented some nasty difficulties for evolutionists, the most notorious of which is the presence of gaps in the fossil record. Evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology doesn't provide them. The gaps must therefore be a contingent feature of the record. George Gaillard Simpson, the leading paleontologist, says, in spite of these examples, it remains true, as every paleontologist knows, that most new species, genera and families, and nearly all categories above the level of families, appear in the fossil record suddenly. Dr. Neville George, professor of geology at the University of Glasgow, says there's no need to apologize any longer for the poverty of the fossil record. It's not that the gaps are there because we don't have enough fossils. In some ways, he says, the record has become almost unmanageably rich in discoveries outpacing immigration. The fossil record, nevertheless, continues to be composed mainly of gaps. Now, that's exactly what we would expect in the creation model. You'd have, in the fossil record, you have variations within the kinds, gaps between the kinds, might have some extinct kinds, like dinosaurs. Just like individuals die, maybe if the environment changes enough, the species can't adjust and will become extinct. But extinction isn't evolution. It's the opposite of evolution. We can see the extinction of the dinosaurs, but that doesn't tell us anything about the evolution of the dinosaurs. So that's what we find in the fossil record as well as in the present world. Now, these gaps are regular and systematic, essentially universal, and this confirms the prediction of the creation model. Now, we ask evolutionists about that, and what they say, what Dr. Simpson says, Dr. Kitts and others, is that evolution took place in spurts. In other words, a small population got isolated from the dominant population, and evolution took place rapidly in a small population. Maybe the mutation rate speeded up because the cosmic ray flux speeded up and caused mutations to increase. So you have rapid evolution in a small population, and therefore you don't get the transitional forms preserved, which may be true. Again, you can't test that. Again, you can't go back and see what happened because it's an event of history and you can't test it. But it may be true. It does seem, though, to creationists that evolutionists are being a little bit unfair here. They say that you can't see any evidence of evolution taking place in the present world because evolution goes too slow. And then you can't see any evolution in the fossil world because evolution went too fast. Well, science is supposed to be what you can see, and the question is, where can you see it? You can walk by faith, not by sight, if you wish, but that's not science when you do that. It's a belief. Well, but aside from that, suppose that these transitional forms did exist, we just haven't found them, or something. Has there really been enough time for evolution? That's the main thing I want to discuss tonight. Now, to have evolution, obviously you have to have hundreds of millions, billions of years to go all the way from one-cell organisms up to man. And so you have to have a lot of time. Creation, the creation model, a period of special creation, well, this could be any time. It doesn't really matter whether it was a long time ago or very recently. But the creation model at least can open its consideration to all the evidence. In other words, if we do find evidence of a young age for a formation, or even for the Earth as a whole, the creation model can take that at face value. Evolution model cannot. It has to find some means of explaining it away, because you can't have a short age if evolution is true. Now, is there any evidence that the age of things is not so great? Yes, there's quite a bit of evidence. The interesting thing is that not very many people know about this. It just hasn't been put into the books, into the classes, and so on, because it doesn't fit the model. Now, understand, nobody can really prove the age of the Earth scientifically, because proof requires observation. We can only observe what we can see now, and of course those people who have lived in previous generations and have observed what they saw and recorded it, well, that's history. We have recorded history. But even that only goes back about 5,000 years, and there's a certain uncertainty there, depending on how you date the first dynasty in Egypt or so on. Maybe 10,000 years. Anyway, several thousand years is as far back as history goes. Now, in terms of observation, you can't know anything beyond that. In order to get a date older than a few thousand years, therefore, you have to use some kind of a physical process. You have to then make certain assumptions about that process. Those assumptions cannot be tested because you can't go back 100,000 years to see whether the assumptions are valid. So there's no way you can be sure. What are the assumptions? Well, the assumptions are three main assumptions, and this has to always be made in any kind of a dating calculation. One assumption is that the system that you're using to measure as your clock has to be a self-contained, closed system. In other words, say take uranium-lead dating. Uranium minerals decay into lead and helium, and you have a certain chain there and certain half-life and so on. They're different isotopes. I won't go into the complexities of it, but basically uranium decays into lead. And so this system that you're using to measure, you find a rock, an igneous rock with a uranium mineral and lead in it. You measure the two, and you have to assume that system has always been closed since that mineral was first formed, so that no lead could have come in from outside or no uranium could have been leached out from outside. In other words, it has to be a closed system. You have to assume that in order to make a meaningful calculation. Second assumption, you have to assume that the process rate, this decay rate or whatever the change is that's taking place in that system, has always been operating at the same rate. If it hasn't, then of course the calculation is meaningless, unless at least you know how it's changed. And then the third assumption, you have to assume that there was none of the daughter product present to begin with, or if there was, you have to know how much was there. You have to have the initial boundary conditions. Those three assumptions have to be present to make a meaningful dating calculation of an apparent age for any rock or for the age of the Earth itself. And if you stop and think about it a moment, you'll realize that none of those assumptions can be tested. No way of testing them. None of those assumptions can be proved. None of them are even reasonable. I would say none of them are even possible. For this reason, in nature, there's no such thing as a closed system. It's an ideal concept which you draw on a blackboard, but you don't have it in the real world. Every system is open to greater or less degree. And particularly in the concept of billions of years of Earth history, with the Earth moving up and down and drifting back and forth and all kinds of fracturing and faulting taking place and groundwater going through everything, to say that these systems have been closed, a tremendous stretch of faith there. A uranium mineral, especially, uranium can be easily leached out of groundwater. And lead can be brought in, and so on. And secondly, there's no reason to think that the decay rate has always been the same. Maybe we can't change it now under certain conditions. But you see, once again, in nature, there's no such thing as a process rate which can't be changed. This includes radioactive decay rates. You can change any kind of a process, because every process depends on a number of factors. If you change any of those factors, you change the rate. Now, all you have to do, you see, in the case of radioactive decay, is to change the factors that influence that particular process. If you can do something to increase the energy state of the atomic nucleus, for example, you can change the decay rate. For example, if you let the atmosphere open up to an increasing influx of cosmic radiation, you would change the decay rate. And so that's a possibility. And then, of course, the question of the initial boundary conditions is the most serious of all. Nobody has any idea what the initial boundary conditions were. Nobody was there. Now, these are not just academic questions, and I want to quickly show that these are real problems. Let me read from an article by Catanzaro and Culp on discordant zircons. Zircon is a uranium mineral. They say the common occurrence of discordant results in isotopic geochronometry presents an intriguing and complicated problem. Discordant results are that you have different calculations you can make. There are different isotopes of uranium and thorium that decay in different isotopes of lead, and each one will give a different, they're usually all found together, so you can make several calculations of the age on the same rock, but normally they don't agree. Discordant results is what they get. And they say that presents a problem. It has become obvious that many mineral samples used in age determinations have not been closed systems throughout their histories. Now, this is common, they say. Many mineral samples have not been closed systems. Well, if the systems aren't closed, if you can't be sure they're closed, then, of course, the calculation doesn't necessarily mean very much. As far as the decay rate is concerned, a recent article in Industrial Research talking about the possibility of a supernova out in space causing a burst of radiation on the Earth, and this is a real possibility. And the author here, Dr. Gentleman, says, being so close, the anisotropic neutrino flux of the super explosion must have had the peculiar characteristic of resetting all our atomic clocks. This would knock our carbon-14, potassium-argon, and uranium-lead dating measurements into a cocktail. The age of prehistoric artifacts, the age of the Earth, that of the universe would be thrown into doubt. Not only could supernova explosions do this, but a reversal of the magnetic field of the Earth would remove the magnetic shield against the cosmic rays, and that would do it, and there are other things that might change. And as a matter of fact, just recently, within the last few years, the concept of the ether has been restored in a new form, in the form of what's called a neutrino sea. In other words, out in space, it's not empty space, but you've got a lot of matter and a lot of energy and a lot of magnetism and so on. And furthermore, a flux of neutrinos everywhere. These are difficult particles to detect, but they're very powerful and highly energized. And if you have an increased flux of neutrinos, for example, on the Earth, it will very definitely increase uranium decay rates. Now, let me read from Dr. H.C. Dudley at the University of Illinois. He's discussing that. He says, during the past decade, there's been developing in astrophysics the concept of a generalized neutrino sea, a flux of uncharged, minute particles that arose from the myriad stars scattered through the universe. This neutrino sea around us has already provided scientists with fresh views on the causes of radioactivity and on methods of increasing the rates of radioactive decay. Radioactive decay rates can be increased, you see, in spite of a lot of understanding of people to the contrary. But the most serious problem is this matter of the initial boundary conditions. How do we know that there was no radiogenic lead, I mean the particular isotope of lead, which was generated from the particular isotope of uranium by the radioactive decay, present to begin with? How do you know that? No way of knowing that. As a matter of fact, it's known that in many cases there is radiogenic lead present, and it has to be corrected for if you can. But how can you be sure? Now, again, that this is a very real problem is illustrated by a study that we had in our Creation Research Society quarterly 2 or 3 years ago. And I might just mention that the Creation Research Society is an organization of creationist scientists. If you think that I'm the only one who holds these strange views, not right. We have thousands of scientists today who do. And these men represent every field. And one of the articles in our Creation Research Society quarterly was a study of the uranium measurements, dating measurements, on rocks of known age. And you see, if you knew the age of a rock, and you could make the uranium dating calculation and then check it, you could check the assumptions if you knew the age of the rock. But how do you know the age of the rock? That's the problem, because they were billions of years ago, supposedly. And not all of them. Some of them have been formed within the historic period. These are volcanic rocks that have been formed within the period of history, last 200 or 1,000 years, by volcanic flows. The magma flows from the mantle up through the volcanic vent, flows out over the surface, becomes a solid rock in a little while. And these have uranium minerals in them, in most cases. Most of this information has been published in Soviet geophysical journals, some of it in English journals. And the British scientists who compiled these data found that there were 20-some of these that had been published in these reputable journals, and all of them gave the uranium dates on these rocks that were known to be young, formed just in the past few hundred years. And in every case, the uranium date on these rocks was hundreds of millions or billions of years. Now, it looks like we have a problem, because here we have a rock, say, which is known to be 1,000 years old, but uranium dating says it's 1 billion years old. Now, what's the problem? The problem is, and this was the explanation given in the journals, that when the magma flowed from the mantle, that the uranium and the lead were already together down here. So they were together here, they flowed together, they stayed together, they cooled together, and therefore when the rock first formed and solidified, this uranium mineral, as it was formed there, already had radiogenic lead with it, so it looked like it was 1 billion years old when it was brand new. Well, that's probably what happened. But then you see the question becomes, it's a different question now. In other words, the question now is, how did the uranium and the lead get together down here? has nothing to do with the decay of the uranium into lead up here. The question is how they got together down here. And understand, that's a different question, because that has to do with the process by which the mantle was formed. It has to do with processes of nucleogenesis, by which the simple elements were built up into the complex elements. Whatever process that may have been, whether it was direct creation or some kind of a nucleogenesis situation, at any rate, you start with hydrogen and build up the uranium. So you go through all the elements, and it's probable that there was some lead there to start with. At any rate, that was the explanation. However it was formed, the real question is this. Since that has been found to be true in all the rocks of known age, it could be tested. How do we know it isn't true in rocks of unknown age? Because they're formed in the same way, by the same process. In other words, uranium minerals are always used to date igneous rocks. And igneous rocks are formed by the flow of a magma from the mantle. And in the flow of igneous rocks from a mantle to form these volcanic rocks, it's the same process. And if uranium and lead are together in the one, they're bound to be together in the other. So therefore, what you really ought to do, you see, it seems to us, is to work out some kind of a correlation, if possible, to say that when you have an apparent age of a billion years, what that really means is 1,000 years, or something like that. At any rate, you can't prove otherwise, you see. You can't go back and really see what these initial conditions were. So it's a very real problem, and it is possible, therefore, to reinterpret the uranium measurements and the potassium measurements and the rubidium measurements by the same kind of checking of the assumptions to correlate with the young age. Well, there are only 3 or 4 of these that give an old age, but there are dozens of them that give a young age. Literally dozens of them. Let me just give you 1 or 2 examples. Trouble is, whenever I talk about time, there's not enough time to talk about time. But let me give you 1 or 2 examples. Dr. Tom Barnes, the University of Texas in El Paso, professor of physics there, written a widely used textbook on terrestrial magnetism, electricity and magnetism, done a tremendous amount of government research in the field of atmospheric physics and magnetism. He's an authority in this field, and one of his research projects, and by the way, Dr. Barnes is a creationist. In fact, he's president of the Creation Research Society now. But in one of his research projects, he came across the history of the measurement of the magnetic field. And he found, I don't know how widely this is known, but he found that ever since the days of Gauss, that the magnetic field has been measured worldwide and averaged out and so on to get a worldwide picture of the magnetic field. That is the strength of it. Now, I'm not talking about the direction, but the strength or the magnetic moment of the field. And the interesting thing is that that magnetic field strength has been decaying for the past 135 years when it's been measured. Now, here we have a worldwide process, a decay process, just like uranium decay, only this is worldwide, whereas uranium decay is limited to a particular rock. Here's a worldwide process, been measured much longer than uranium decay has been measured. We didn't even know about radioactive processes until late in the 19th century. So it's been measured for 135 years, so we have a longer period of measurements, a worldwide process. It looks like a better process by which to measure the age of the Earth. It can measure it can measure the age of the magnetic field, which is probably the same as the age of the Earth. Now, the magnetic field is apparently caused by the circulation of electrical currents down in the Earth's core. It's about the only thing that could cause it. But a circulating current will generate a magnetic field, of course. But the currents have to circulate against resistance, and consequently, they gradually decay unless somehow they are continually reinvigorated from some source. But apparently, they're not, because there's no source there to do it, so they decay. And in the process of decay, the magnetic field decays. And this has been measured, and it turns out that the half-life, based on a least squares analysis of the curve of best fit to all the data worldwide for 130 years, is the half-life of 1,400 years. The Earth's magnetic field, in other words, is decaying such that in 1,400 years from now, it'll only be half as strong. And as a matter of fact, you can go to 5,900 years, I think it is, from now, and it'll be gone. There won't be any magnetic field. Now, in other words, it's going down. Now, once it goes down and goes to zero, now, some would think, well, now maybe it's going to reverse itself and go in the other direction, but now how's that going to happen? Because you've got to have, if you're going to lose all the energy, you've got to have some source to drive it up again, and that hasn't been figured out yet. So apparently when it dies, that's the end of it, as far as we can see now. Nothing that we know of that would regenerate these currents in another direction. At any rate, if you go back in time, 1,400 years ago, the magnetic field was twice as strong as it is now, and if you go back 2,800 years, 4 times as strong, and so on. If you go back 7,000 years, it's 32 times as strong. And that's about as strong as it could have been. Dr. Bourne's calculated that if you go back 10,000 years, the heating effect from these currents, and by the way, another interesting facet about his calculation is, if you have a decaying magnetic field, that will generate a current. And he found that the whole system is self-contained. The rate of decay is sufficient to generate the currents that are necessary to keep the thing going. So you don't need any other source. It's a complete self-contained system. At any rate, the heating effect would have been so great, he found that 10,000 years ago, the dispersion of heat through the Earth, not to mention the radioactive heat, but just from the magnetic field, would have been so great that the Earth's crust and mantle would have been just sort of fused together. And if you go back 500,000 years, the heating effect would have been so great that the Earth would have been vaporized. And 500,000 years isn't so very long. That's only back into the Ice Age, supposedly, by the standard system of dating. And furthermore, it's not even as far back as the last reversal of the magnetic field, which is about 700,000 years ago, supposedly. Well, these two seem to conflict, but we would suggest that the data for the decay of the magnetic field is stronger than that for uranium decay, or for the reversal of the magnetic field, for that matter. At any rate, here's one method. Now, there are dozens of others. If you take the rate at which helium is escaping into the atmosphere from the Earth, from uranium decay, and also coming into the atmosphere from outer space in the solar corona, in other words, coming in both directions, no evidence it's escaping from the atmosphere, it's coming in from both directions, it turns out that the age of the atmosphere by helium dating is probably 10,000 years or thereabout. If you take the rate at which uranium is being transported to the ocean, uranium being leached out by groundwater and going through rivers to the ocean, and you assume that there was none in the ocean to begin with, it turns out the age of the ocean by that sort of uranium dating is somewhere between 100,000 years to 10,000 years. If you take all the other chemicals in the ocean, you can go down the line of every chemical that's in the ocean and the chemicals that are being brought into the ocean by the rivers and make a calculation, uniformitarian calculation with these assumptions that I was talking about. In every case, you'll find an age for the ocean. It'll all be different, of course, because you're assuming there was no chemical there to start with, and the rate's always been the same, and that's probably not a good assumption. But you'll get all kinds of ages, from 100 years in the case of aluminum, up to about 300 million years in the case of sodium, but none of them will give anything like a billion years. They'll all give much less than the time required for evolution. And on and on, the rate at which meteoritic dust is coming into the Earth from outer space, that's been measured. If it were accumulating at the same rate that it is today for 5 billion years, the supposed age of the Earth, there would be a layer of meteoritic dust all around the Earth, 187 feet thick. There's no sign of it. And furthermore, it hasn't been dispersed through the crust or washed into the ocean because meteoritic material has a high nickel content, much higher than ordinary Earth material. And you can measure the amount of nickel that's gone into the ocean, the amount that's in the deep sea sediments, and the amount that's in the Earth's crust. And more than all of the nickel everywhere could have been accounted for just by influx of meteoritic dust that way in 5 billion years. So there are many, many evidences. In one of my little papers, I have a list of 76 processes, 76 physical processes of all sorts, which would give an age for the Earth much too young for evolution. And there are only three or four that will support an age for the Earth old enough, supposedly, for evolution. If you have to make uniformitarian assumptions, and you have to, you see, to get any kind of a date, you have to make these assumptions, otherwise, no way of making the calculation. It does seem like this, that uniformitarianism, closed system, constant rate, and so on, is more likely to be a valid assumption for a short period of time than for a long period. The longer the period, the more likely it's going to get wrong. So, therefore, the dating calculations that give young ages are more likely to be correct than those that give old ages, other things being equal. And besides that, there are many more of them. Now, it seems that the weight of evidence is in terms of a recent origin for the Earth. And you can also discuss human populations and show that the present population can easily be accounted for, even at only one-fourth of the present growth rate, in about 4,500 years. So everywhere you look, you find evidence that the Earth and man and life are all quite young. But apart from that, even if we accept the geological age system and the billion-year history of the Earth and so on, there still is no way that evolution is really possible. Now, I'm speaking in terms of a law of science called the second law of thermodynamics, or the law of entropy. Now, when I say possible, I'm saying it's possible only if something goes wrong with the second law of thermodynamics, if there's some kind of an exception to it. But in terms of what we know in science, there's no exception. You see, maybe I better quote. Here's Isaac Asimov, one of my favorite writers. He's the most prolific science writer of our day, over 140 books or so. He says, as far as we know, all changes are in the direction of increasing entropy, which means increasing disorder, increasing randomness, running down. Now, this is common to everybody's experience. You know that any kind of a system, if you just let it go, tends to run down, go towards disorder. That's why things wear out, get old. If you just let your room go, it'll go towards disorder. Let the top of your desk go, like mine, it goes toward disorder. Anything that you just let go, do what comes naturally, it'll become disorder. And that has been formalized into what's called the second law of thermodynamics. Now, there are different ways. That's why things wear out, get old. If you just let your room go, it'll go towards disorder. Let the top of your desk go, like mine, it goes toward disorder. Anything that you just let go, do what comes naturally, it'll become disorder. And that has been formalized into what's called the second law of thermodynamics. Now, there are different ways in which that law can be expressed. You can talk about classical thermodynamics, in which you're talking about the increasing unavailability of energy. You can talk about statistical thermodynamics, in which you're talking about increasing disorder or probability or randomness. You can talk about informational thermodynamics, in which we have to do with the increasing noise and static, trying to communicate in information systems, that you, as you try to convey information, you lose some of it. Now, however you express it, they're really all the same thing. They're equivalent to each other. Always we have this tendency to go from order to disorder. Now, that's a universal law of science, if there is such a thing. Let me quote from Harold Bloom, Princeton biochemist. He says, in his article, Perspectives in Evolution, he says, a major consequence, this was in the American Scientist, a major consequence of the second law of thermodynamics is that all real processes go toward a condition of greater probability. The probability function generally used in thermodynamics is entropy. Orderliness is associated with low entropy, randomness with high entropy. The second law of thermodynamics says that left to itself, any isolated system will go toward greater entropy, which means greater randomness and greater likelihood. Now, this is a universal law. He says all real processes understand. Now, some people have the notion this only applies to chemistry or physics or engineering, but it doesn't. It applies to all real processes. Every process obeys this law. That's the second law. The first law of thermodynamics is essentially the same as the law of conservation of matter and energy. Mass, matter, and energy, of course, can be interchanged so that matter is a form of energy or vice versa, whichever way you want to look at it. But at any rate, the totality of matter and energy cannot be either created or destroyed. The quantity stays the same. But the quality goes down. That's the second law. Quantity is constant. Quality decreases. That's true in every system that we can measure. It's true in every, isolated system, which we can make all the measurements involved. And since the whole is the sum of its parts, you can broaden this system or you can add on as many as you want to, and therefore, as far as we can tell, it applies to the universe as a whole. The whole universe is running down. Now, in terms of energy, there's an interesting relationship that immediately develops. The sources of energy for the Earth's processes come mainly from the sun. Now, the Earth is an open system, of course. It's open to the energy of the sun, and the sun's energy bathes the Earth and runs the Earth system. But eventually the sun's going to burn out, presumably, if it keeps on long enough, and so will the stars, and so will everything else. And finally, maybe billions of years in the future, but eventually all the highly available energy sources in the universe will become unavailable. The entropy increases. Sir Arthur Eddington, the great British physicist of last generation, called this law time's arrow. In other words, as time goes on, the arrow points down. So that the universe is heading downhill towards an ultimate heat death, when all the available energy will have been degraded into low-level uniform heat, randomly dispersed molecules through space, complete randomness, in other words, complete disorder, no information, no order, no energy available for work. It'll still be here by the first law, but it won't be useful. It'll be dead by the second law. Now, that's what's going to happen if these laws continue to operate in the physical universe as they are now. be a long time, but eventually it'll happen in time. And the significant thing is it hasn't happened yet. If the universe were infinitely old, it would already have happened, because it's going to happen in time. But it hasn't happened, therefore the universe had a beginning. So there must have been a time, as you project back in time, the energy available increases, because as you go forward in time, it decreases. As you go back in time, it would increase, but you can't go back beyond the point where the total available energy is greater than the total energy. You can maybe go back to that point. That would be time zero, when the total energy in the universe is equal to the total available energy, available to do work. Can't go back beyond that. Well, there's a singularity or a point of discontinuity. And what does that mean? It means at that point the universe was wound up. All the energy was available. Everything was ordered. All the information was there. Been running down ever since, like a great watch. Wound up, now running down. Well, what wound the watch up? What wound the universe up? Or maybe you should say who, but at any rate, you do have that question, and understand that the first law says that the universe could not wind itself up. The universe is not a closed system, after all, because it couldn't have wound itself up. Because the first law says within the present structure of the universe, nothing is being created. But there must have been a creation. But the universe couldn't create itself by the first law. But there must have been a creation by the second law. What's the answer? Well, there must have been something to create the universe, or to order it, or to wind it up, however you want to express it, which is outside of the universe. The universe is an open system, and there's some kind of ordering source out there that orders it and energizes it and gets it going. But it's not in the universe, it's outside of it, transcendent to it. Well, that sounds like an old statement that's been around for a long time. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, in other words, the most scientific conclusion to which we can come based on the two most certain laws of science is that there must have been a creation in time, and furthermore, that creator who created it must have been capable of creating the universe. And consequently, creating all the ordered systems, the tremendously intelligible universe capable of being studied by intelligent people. Matter of fact, capable of creating intelligent people. Matter of fact, able to create people in terms of cause and effect, which is a scientific principle, of course. There can be no effect greater than the cause. So how can you have random, impersonal, unthinking particles produce thinking, personal, intelligent people? There's no way that can be valid in terms of cause and effect, in terms of what we know in science as the principle of cause and effect. So there must be an effect, or a cause able to produce these effects, and that sounds like a personal creator. Well, but that has to do with the universal principle of thermodynamics. What about on a local scale? Now, you get the point, I'm sure, that in terms of this basic law, a universal tendency towards disorder seems to contradict the idea of evolution, which says there's a universal tendency towards greater order. If evolution is true, we've gone in billions of years all the way from random particles up to complex people. Tremendous increase in order. That seems to be going against the second law of thermodynamics. Well, which is right, or can they both be true? Well, as universal principles, it does look like they can't both be true if the English language makes sense. You can't have a universal principle of change which is exactly the converse of another universal principle of change. They can't be equal and opposite and both be true. So, as universals, they can't both be true. But you see, the concept of evolution has not been proved scientifically to be a fact, in spite of what DeBose and Huxley and others say. It has not been proved. It has not been tested. There's no way you can test it, as we've seen. So it's simply a belief. It's a model. And it contradicts the second law of thermodynamics, which can be tested and which has been tested on all kinds of systems, chemical, physical, small scale, big scale. There's no exception ever found. If there is such a thing as a law of science, the second law is it, and it's opposite to the concept of evolution. So if you have to make a choice, I would suggest that you'd better go with science rather than metaphysics or speculation, because that's what you have to do to believe that evolution is a universal principle of the universe. Well, but maybe it could apply on a small scale. In other words, what about the Earth itself? For a small time in space, such as the Earth over geological time, could it be that you could have an increasing complexity of the biosphere in spite of the second law of thermodynamics? Yes, philosophically it's possible. Because these laws of thermodynamics, of course, have to be defined in terms of closed systems, and the Earth isn't a closed system. The Earth is an open system. And so, if you have energy coming in from the sun, there is no doubt enough energy coming in from the sun to support the evolutionary process for a long time until finally the sun burns out and the whole thing stops. But it could maybe work for a while. But wait now, you've got to have more than just an open system. Now we creationists believe that the second law of thermodynamics really precludes even the very possibility of evolution on any significant scale. Because they're the opposite of each other. There's a universal tendency towards disorder, whereas evolution speaks of a tendency towards increasing order. But when we raise this point and make this point, for example, we have had a number of debates. I quoted Dr. Kitts a while ago. We had a debate with Dr. Kitts a couple of years ago at the University of Oklahoma, and Dr. Gish, my colleague, will be having one at the University of Missouri shortly. So we've had a number of these, and we always make quite a point of the second law of thermodynamics because we think that's a very important point. But usually the response we get is, but that doesn't apply because the Earth is an open system and the second law applies to closed systems. Okay, now I want to address that point, so don't say later that this doesn't apply because the Earth is an open system. I'm at least going to try to deal with that point. Now, if all you have to have, you see, to increase order is to have an open system with available energy coming into that system, think what a wonderful world this would be if that's all you have to have. For example, my field has been engineering, water resources. Dams are pretty expensive structures, and I've done some work on some of them. And it would sure be nice if we could just lay the concrete material, the sand and the gravel and the cement out there and the steel out on the construction site and say, now, here we have an open system, and the sun's energy is there bathing this site, and there's plenty of energy coming in from the sun to build that dam. Plenty of energy to do that, and it's an open system, and that's all we have to have. Why, let it do it. Go ahead. By some sort of a natural selection process, let the dam gradually build up. Well, that's not entirely facetious, because that's essentially the same argument. If all you have to have is an open system and available energy, why, you've got that. As a matter of fact, every system is an open system with available energy. And furthermore, every system is an open system open to the energy of the sun, either directly or indirectly, either largely or minutely, to some degree. Every system is an open system open to the energy of the sun. So to say that really doesn't say anything. To say that the Earth is an open system open to the energy of the sun is really a vacuous statement, because that applies to every system, and therefore it has no specific information for any particular system. And so that's not enough. That's not an answer to this problem. We have a serious problem here. The second law of thermodynamics says systems go downhill. Evolution says they go uphill. Now, what do you have to make a system go uphill? Now, you can do that, all right. There's certain criteria that you can apply, and they'll make a system become more ordered. You can make this pile of construction materials become a dam or a building. Here you're going against the second law. You're increasing the order of that set of components. Or in the living world, you can take a seed, and the seed will grow up into a tree with lots of seeds. That seems to be going against the second law. Or you can take an embryo, and it'll become an animal, and so on. Well, you do have these growth systems in which the order is increasing. But in every case, you have more than just an open system with available energy. What else do you have to have? Now, you stop and think a moment. And if you do, you'll find that in every kind of a growth system that occurs in either a natural or an artificial process, every case you have at least two additional conditions satisfied that have to be there. In the first place, in order to have a growth in order, you have to have some kind of a program to direct that growth in order, some sort of a blueprint or a code or a template or something to tell it how to grow. If you just let a system grow randomly and heterogeneously, it'll become a blob if it grows at all. More likely, it'll break down. You see, sometimes evolutionists, for example, Thomas Huxley used to say that if you let monkeys peck away at typewriter keys long enough, they'll eventually peck out the works of Shakespeare. The idea is anything can happen if you have enough time. But that's not enough of an answer, because time doesn't solve this problem. You see, as time goes on, that pile of bricks doesn't become a building, they become dust. That's what happens as time goes on. That's what the second law says. That's time's arrow. And the same thing would happen in the living world if you just let the system be open and have enough time, it'll break down and become disordered. If you let the seed rest out on the concrete driveway for long enough, it'll disintegrate. Now, you have to have some other conditions. You have to have this code which directs the growth. In the case of the building or the dam, you have the blueprint, so on, that tells where to put the different components. In the case of the seed, you have the marvelous information program in the living cell, and that's a tremendously complex thing. The genetic code and the DNA molecule and all the other information programs and the different components of the cell, all of these have tremendous order to them, and they direct the growth. And if you didn't have that information program there, no matter how much energy comes in, you'll not get any growth. You have to have the code. Another thing you have to have is some kind of a converter or a motor or a membrane or something to take the environmental energy and store it and then convert it and give it out in the right way and time in order to convert that available energy through different stages into the specific work that you need to do to build up this complex structure. In the case of the seed, you have the marvelous mechanism of photosynthesis to do that. Now, nobody understands photosynthesis too well. It involves electrochemical reactions and microorganisms and a lot of things. It's a very complex thing. But if you don't have it, you're not going to get that seed growing up into a tree, no matter how much energy you have. But somehow that mechanism, whatever it is, takes the sun's energy and the other energy sources and converts them into the specific work of building up the tissues and the cells and so on in the plant. If you didn't have that mechanism, that converter, you wouldn't get the plant to grow either. And in the animal, you have these processes of metabolism and so on. And in every kind of a growth system, you have both a code and a mechanism, or you don't get any growth. Now, what about evolution? Here we have the greatest growth process of all, because here we have a marvelous continuum in space-time. And they're all interconnected, you see. The first primitive cell is connected by a natural process to man. It's all a continuum in space-time, so it's a tremendously big system, say the structure of the biosphere, and that has increased in complexity tremendously over the geological ages, if evolutionary model is correct. Now, what causes this tremendous increase in complexity? You have to have not only the sun and the earth as an open system, you do have that, but that's incidental because you have that all the time in every system. You have to have, in addition, some kind of a code which takes the sun's energy and directs it how to grow into the evolutionary complexity of the biosphere. And furthermore, you have to have some kind of a motor or a membrane or something to store the sun's energy and give it out in the right portions of space and time to convert it into the specific work of building up the complexity of the biosphere. Now, you have to have both that code and mechanism. And so far as we know, as yet anyway, the evolutionary system does not have it. So it isn't sufficient simply to say that the Earth is an open system and therefore the second law doesn't apply. Well, yes, it does apply, unless you have a code and a mechanism to offset the second law. Now, don't say that mutation and natural selection do this, because mutation is not a code. Mutation is a random process. Natural selection is not a converter of energy. It's simply a sieve that waits for mutations to come along. And as far as mutations are concerned, although they may respond to energy, external energy, that doesn't cause them to build up complexity. It goes in the other direction. A random mutation, a random process, decreases order, not increases. So, and natural selection certainly doesn't convert any energy. And by itself, it can be no code. It has to wait for mutations to come along, so that neither of these, neither mutation or natural selection, is either a code or a mechanism. And if neither is either, they can't both be both. And you must have both to get growth. Now, until the evolutionary model can not only speculate but demonstrate that there is a biochemical predestinating code to direct this tremendous growth and a marvelous converter to convert the sun's energy into that growth. And by the way, something has to provide the sun's energy in the first place. But until they can do that, why, it does not square with the second law of thermodynamics. And the second law of thermodynamics seems to preclude the possibility of evolution on any significant scale. Now, I have dealt with the open system argument, understand. And the answer has to be in terms of a code and a mechanism, and so far there's no answer. Now, that doesn't mean that someday the evolutionary model may not be able to find such an answer. Be able to find some kind of a system which does direct the process and energize it some way. Maybe they will. Haven't yet, nowhere near it. But even if they ever do, it still won't be as good as the creation model, because the creation model does not have to explain the second law of thermodynamics. Matter of fact, the creation model predicts the second law of thermodynamics. It says, in its basic form, that the Creator made things the way He wanted them to begin with, and that's perfect. Of course, by definition, the Creator knows what He's doing, and He's able to do it, so it makes them the way they should be. And you can't improve perfect, so if any extraneous, external factor comes in to force a change, and the vertical direction is going to go downhill, not uphill. So the creation model predicts that the basic principles in nature would be principles of conservation, the first law of thermodynamics, and decay, the second law. So they fit perfectly well the creation model. We suggest, therefore, that creation as a concept does square directly and easily with all the scientific data. Now that doesn't say that we have proved creation to be true, or disproved evolution, any more than evolution can be proved to be true, or creation to be disproved. You can't repeat history. So nobody can know scientifically which one is true. In order really to know which is right, why, you have to have somebody who was there to see what happened and record it, write it down. It's the only way you can know. And since this requires a creator, this means that somehow the creator has to tell us about it. Now, up to this point, I haven't discussed religion. And I want to make that point. In other words, when we're suggesting that creation be taught as an alternative, don't respond by saying creation is religion and evolution is science. I'll talk a little over an hour here now, and I'm closing right now. Without mentioning the book of Genesis, without quoting the Bible, without discussing theology or religious literature, we've just been discussing the scientific data, and we've shown that the scientific data do fit the creation model. And we think better than they fit the evolution model. At least, there's a good enough case to where it ought to be available. Amazing thing is that only evolution is taught just about everywhere in our society. And yet the facts to creation, better, at least as well. Now that's a strange thing, and I suggest that it's time that we open up our society and make both points of view with the evidence for and against each available, somewhat the same way that I've done tonight, to everybody, and let everybody make up their own minds. We're not telling you what to believe. You finally have to decide one or the other. You believe one or the other. But that's a spiritual decision, not a scientific decision. And that should be made on the basis of theological, spiritual considerations. Is there no purpose in the universe? Well, then evolution is a satisfactory model. And if you have no goal or purpose, if everything satisfies you on a random basis, fine, it's your decision. But if you are looking for purpose and meaning and order in the universe and meaning to life and a goal to history, why, this fits the creation model. But that's a spiritual decision, not a scientific decision. Well, you've been very patient, and I appreciate the opportunity of speaking to you. Thank you very much.